the state of lending.
Finding a lender that will invest is really important.
Welcome to the Mortgage Impact Podcast, your home for industry-related marketing, branding, leadership, and technology news, best practices, and more. Whether you're a loan officer or a senior executive, this podcast will help you make an impact in the mortgage industry. Now, here's your host, Jake Failing.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the second installment of Coffee with Casey here on the Mortgage Impact Podcast. I'm Jake Failing. In the second installment, you'll hear Movement Mortgage CEO Casey Crawford sit with Nima Gamsari, who is the founder and CEO of Blend. Movement and Blend have been partners for a couple years now, and Easy App was the product of that relationship, and the two have stayed in touch ever since that initial relationship. So you'll hear them talk about personal and professional in this one. It's both motivating and inspiring, and hopefully brings you a little bit of value. Enjoy.
Man, Nima, thank you so much for doing Coffee with Casey, man. I think everyone watching knows, if you don't know, you are CEO of one of the hottest companies in Silicon Valley, founder and CEO, I might add. And I know you personally, and I know some of the backstory, and that's what a lot of people, I think, watching this don't know, man. Would you share with folks just kind of some of your personal backstory? Because I just think you're one of the great success stories in American business right now.
Yeah, and by the way, thanks for having me. Coffee and Casey, two of my favorite things, so it's a good combo. I was born in Iran in the 80s. My parents and my sister and myself moved here to the Midwest in 1986.
Wow.
And right after the revolution there.
Yeah.
And they came here with basically nothing. Mm. And we grew up and we were not really sure how we were gonna ever make it in the country. My parents came here and like, getting a job in a country where you barely know the language is almost impossible. And so anyways, you know, long story short, in like the late 90s, they had saved like $5,000 over the course of 15 years,
wow,
which is not a lot of money to save. But then somebody was like, hey, you should get a mortgage. And it's, I know it sounds cheesy because like people say getting a house is the American dream, but that mortgage that they got for $5,000 down in 1998, 20 years later is like all of their asset. It's like, wow, it's been so powerful and so important for them because that created the ability for them to basically build wealth instead of paying rent.
Change the trajectory of their life.
They retired last year, I think, because they got a mortgage. So it's something that this industry, that's not why we started Blend, but
sure,
like that was something that really stuck with me as you know, like you probably do so many loans now here at Movement. And so it's like, you're doing 50,000 loans, but you know, those are people, those are families, and it's pretty cool to be able to see the impact, the real impact. But anyways, that's part of my story. I grew up in Cincinnati, grew up in the Midwest, and
Bengals fan.
Big Bengals fan.
Sorry.
One day I'm gonna try to buy.
Were you
that
at least
team.
There for Icky? I mean, was the Icky shuffle in your era? Were you there a fan at that point?
No, man, no. I mean, unfortunately, we're notorious for not having won a playoff game for the 18 years I lived in Cincinnati. So. But one day
you can help change that story.
Yeah, I could buy the team. Yeah. This could be the year. But yeah, I grew up in Cincinnati and then went to Stanford and studied computer science. Almost went into finance. No offense to all the finance people, but you know, wasn't for me. And ended up joining an early stage tech company that was focused on data, and it got me started in this world.
Yeah, yeah. So I know you got to Stanford, man, and I know you know mom and dad's so proud. They got you there. You're hardworking, and you had to work. You know, with Stanford, I played football, which I kind of tell guys is basically like having a full time job. I was playing football and baseball in college, and you had to have a job also. You applied at a couple places. Did they work out? Tell a little bit of that story, man. That's a pretty neat. A lot of folks watching this too are young. We get a lot of questions from aspiring entrepreneurs. They'll say, hey, what's it like to start a company? And I always talk about, you know, those early, my early times on teams when I worked for different leaders and the hard work it takes, man, that kind of being something that's indicative usually throughout your lifetime. So if you're in college, kind of having some of those experiences, that was yours. You had to not only go to school, but work. What did that look like?
Yeah, well, and even going before that, when I was in high school, I worked at McDonald's and Starbucks and Circuit City, you know, 3 different years. I worked for 3 different companies.
Wow.
And and it was actually, you know, it was pretty cool working at those companies.
Yep.
First of all, it teaches you a thing or two about customer service and how important that is.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, you know, I had to pay my buy my car.
Yep.
It's not a nice car, but I had to buy a car and I had to pay for gas and I had to pay for car insurance and I loved ramen noodles, so that was like a go-to staple for me. It's probably why I'm not as healthy as you. But anyways, I so but then but one of the other thing is I did in high school was I started a few businesses on eBay because it was early days eBay, pre-PayPal,
yeah,
buying and selling trading cards. I don't know if you've ever heard of Magic the Gathering.
Oh, yeah.
It was a pretty cool kids card game back then. And we would buy and sell these cards. And it was like the early days. It was like the first online garage sale. And so you could make like a couple $1,000s, you know, a summer if you just hustled.
Yeah.
And you worked hard and you found the good deals and then you sold them somewhere else. And it was like a pretty cool experience. But anyways, when I got to college, I didn't have enough for all the room and board. So I had to get a job. You know, I had paid everything I could for books and whatever. But I had to get a job and I went and applied at Starbucks. I got an offer there. And one of my friends saw me and was like, dude, don't go work at Starbucks. You should do this rake back deal with this poker site.
Online poker is what we're talking about here.
Online poker. Okay, to be clear.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to be clear, this was right after, I don't know if you remember, like Chris Moneymaker,
yes,
won the World Series of poker.
Yes. Yes. 2004. Crazy hot. Yeah.
The crazy, and so Chris Moneymaker, 2004, World Series of Poker, is big on ESPN. The first year it's on ESPN, everyone's pumped about it.
Freshman at Stanford, and you're going to...
Freshman at Stanford.
It's Starbucks, McDonald's, or online poker.
Or online poker.
All right, got it.
And I'm like, rake back, what's that? And he's like, if you play enough hands, they'll pay you like $300. I only needed like a couple $1,000s.
Yeah.
You know, a quarter to be able to pay for the room and board. So I started playing... This online poker, I got a free sign-up bonus. He referred me, so he got a referral bonus. I'm playing on this poker site, and I instantly lose all my money. And it's like, oh man, all right, I got to go get a real job. And then that Friday, there was this tournament, this free roll tournament for all the new players, and I basically lucked my way into third place and won like $700. And so now I had like a real bankroll. I could play
real bankroll, $700.
$700.
Yeah, unlimited almost in college.
And I downloaded all these books, and I started reading these. Really serious books. So people think poker is about math and probability, which the basics are, but really is around theory and psychology. Like that was like the depth. And so I started reading all these books and participating in these forums. By the way, communities can be really powerful for learning too.
Yep.
And it turns out actually like with real hard work, I was really good. And then within 6 months, I had paid for the next 4 years of Stanford, and it was pretty cool.
Within 6 months of learning the game online poker, you get online and you start smashing the hottest players in the world.
Yeah, I mean, not the hottest players in the world always, but even just like, I mean, early, I was like, there was a really hype time in the poker world. But yeah, I was pretty good. And I think that it was just like, I put in the work.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
so I didn't know all this about you when we first met. I didn't know all this backstory, but people always ask, you know, how do you know somebody's gonna be successful? And I always say, man, you can usually look back in their past and something in their history, and they've had success in a lot of things. Gary Vee talks a lot about, hey, if you're an entrepreneur, it bites you by 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, hey, man, you know, you're selling eBay, you know, cards on eBay and selling stuff on eBay at like a young age. You're an entrepreneur at a young age, man. Like, you saw opportunity in things and places that people didn't necessarily see it at a really young age. Bit you early. Get to college and you can have a job, or you see like an unlimited upside opportunity in like kind of a new business where you can kind of use your unique skills, gifts to dominate, and then you did it. So, I mean, It's always interesting to me to watch guys have success in different venues over time. And man, it's no surprise you've built an amazing company today in Blend in Silicon Valley. That was kind of the latest and greatest. But there's some evolutions between online poker and a billion-dollar unicorn startup in Silicon Valley.
Right.
what do those look like?
You know, I think the beauty of online poker is it also taught me a lot of other things. Like, you know, one of the things about business that you probably have to deal with is there's so many ups and downs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, you can't be risk, like, you have to find a way to work through the ups and downs. Like, you can't be risk averse. You can't be afraid to take a risk because something's going to go wrong. I had years where I was probably one of the top earners in the entire poker world, and I had years where I made no money.
Same guy. You're the same guy.
I'm the same
You're
guy.
The same guy.
I'm the same guy. And I'm sure in the mortgage business today, there are people who are making very little money this year.
Yep. Same guys and they were last
same
year.
Same guys they were last year.
Yep.
And last year they were making a lot of money, and they're like, what's different? Well, it's like the world has ups and downs.
Yes.
And like, you have to fight through the
game
learn
changes.
From them. And the game changes, and you have to evolve with the game. And so I also like, I think I, you know, it's like definitely so it taught me a lot from that perspective. It also taught me not to always focus on the results, because you could make bad plays and still have good outcomes.
Yeah.
So it taught me a lot of stuff.
Both ways, right? Like, just because you won doesn't mean you were that good. And just because you lost doesn't mean you were that bad.
Exactly.
Reggie White used to always say that to me in the locker room, man. He'd go, hey, Case, don't read the headlines. So what are we talking about? He goes, hey, listen, when they're praising you, they're usually not right. And when they're dogging you, they're usually not right either, right? Like, either way, it's probably exaggerated.
Go and evaluate your own play.
Yeah,
go and study your own play. Go work with people. I had coaches. I'm sure you had coaches who would tell you.
You still do.
I still do.
Exactly. Like, I mean, that's a huge thing for you and for me. I mean, you have amazing mentors that are still pouring into you all the time. You got to lead. You have to go out there and do it. But man, having some older, wiser guys to guide you along the road has been, I know, critical kind of in your path.
Well, and the problem is, like, you know, the kids in school, they, in high school and college, yep. they're taught to be right all the time. Right? Like, they're graded on whether the right, the outcome is right. And like, even if their thought process was right, and the very, I remember I had this is why I'm not a huge fan of college, you know, today.
Right there. This is coming, like, from Stanford.
This is good. I had this exam, and I love Stanford. Is a fantastic school.
It's a fantastic school. It is a fantastic school.
Yes. But we had this exam where I had, like, this, like, long 10-part question. And I got the final answer wrong because I, like, forgot a minus sign, a negative sign somewhere.
Right.
But the thought process is right. The problem solving is right. I made a stupid mistake. And instead of I got a 0 out of 10 on that question. And I was like, how does that make any sense?
Wow.
And, like, that's how kids, and then kids come into the workforce. I shouldn't say kids. Like, these are like.
Yeah, you're pretty young yourself.
These are like, they're adults, but they're, you know, they're 22, 23 years old, and they come into the workplace and they're so afraid to make a mistake. And they're so afraid to make a mistake because they were coached by everybody in college and in high school to not make mistakes.
Towards perfection.
Whereas I think that's the opposite of poker taught me, the opposite. Man. So I was about to go into finance in 2004 or 2008, I should say, when I was graduating. I was supposed to start on Sunday. My sister worked at this bank, and she said, "Come be on the trading desk here."
Wow.
And be, you know, a coder. I had a coding background. And on the Friday before, this was like 2008, right before the crisis, it was July 4th weekend, I called my boss there, and my soon-to-be boss there, and I was like, you know, my heart's not in it. Like, I want to stay here and build stuff. And he's like, what? Like, this is, like, a great opportunity for you. And my parents were really upset, which I don't blame them.
Yeah.
Going from, like, this really fantastic to, basically, I didn't have a job. I had an offer at Palantir. I hadn't accepted it yet, but I didn't have a job yet. And so, like, going from this amazing six-figure finance offer to basically nothing was pretty frightening for my parents. And so, but yeah, so I, you know, I ended up doing that. I ended up
So once again, though, like, you took a risk, right? Like, your journey wasn't marked by making every safe move, getting it perfect, only playing games you knew you could win. I mean, you jumped into online poker, right back. You could have gone to work for Starbucks. Pretty sure you'd have made $8-9 an hour. You would have had benefits, right? It's a great company. They do that kind of thing. You instead took the kind of road less traveled, took a riskier path, and man, became one of the top poker players in the world. But it, like, had ups and downs, right? And then I know your journey when you started with Palantir, like, that was a bit of a risk. And that was, for folks that don't know, you know, Palantir is probably one of the biggest, most successful companies that not everybody's heard of.
Right.
Give them a quick, you know, profile on Palantir.
Yeah, Palantir is a data and analytics company that builds software that helps big organizations use their data better.
Founded by Peter Thiel.
Peter Thiel.
Right? Yeah, one of the top kind of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs in there, and became, I know, a mentor of yours also.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, started in 2008. I started there in 2008. The company started in 2005, 2006. It was pretty early days. We were, you know, a startup, and we were figuring things out. We were figuring out how to go into the, our business had all been in government, like defense, things, intelligence, things like that. But we wanted to expand into the private sector, and so that was a big part of what I went there to do. But I'll say, just like in anything, just going back to your point about taking different paths and figuring out what the right path is, I made sure it was a path that I was willing to give it all to. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go somewhere that I wasn't going to give it my all.
Yeah,
because I don't like to diversify. That's why I'd be a bad venture capitalist.
All in.
I'm an all in guy. I'm an all in guy.
Was, like, that seriously, your move?
That wasn't my move in poker, but I was all in, like, in terms of, like, I was studying
life. Yeah,
I was studying more on poker than people. I was studying like 70 hours a week.
Wow.
Just on poker, just studying poker, not even playing, just trying to learn it. And so you have to be.
You
all
weren't
in.
Dabbling.
I was not dabbling. These things are all in, or these are all in or nothing. That's my rule on those kinds of things. So Palantir is this really great company that wants to get in the private sector, and then right then. At the moment I turned down this banking job, the entire banking sector is, like, starting to collapse. Lehman's going out of business. I look like a genius.
It was
not premeditated. It was just luck. It was just my heart wasn't in it. And so Palantir, you know, we were presented this opportunity to work on some of the mortgage books that were distressed in 2009, 2010, 2011. And it gave me a really deep and sort of interesting perspective from a technologist perspective into the mortgage world and how paper-based it is. And how much asymmetry of information there is, and how complexity in a system like this could lead to really big downstream implications. for millions of consumers.
Right. And I mean, I remember some of your stories, and they're horrifying, of just what you were exposed to when you were at Palantir. You basically saw the depth of the problem,
yeah.
you know, of what was going on in the United States. How did you make the decision, Nima, to leave Palantir, a safe, you know, relatively safe job, you're having great success, and then you knew, hey, you know, now's the time, I'm going to strike out, I'm going to found my own company, I'm going to become a CEO, founder. You're still relatively, well, extremely young at the time. You're still pretty young, wise beyond your years. How'd you make that decision? A lot of people ask that question, you know, how did you know when it was time to step out and do something on your own? You kind of have a history of doing that, but what did that look like? What did that decision process look like at Palantir?
I think it was just, there was something that, it really was simple, actually. It's like there's something that I thought needed to exist in the world, which is now Blend.
Yeah.
That did not exist in the world.
Man, I love it.
And I thought that the best way to make it exist was to go and build it.
Had to be you.
Had to be me.
Yeah.
I honestly really believe that if we didn't build this thing,
yeah.
that it would not be built.
Man, I love that. I tell guys all the time, so man, like God made one you. Like one you. There's no more Nemas
Figure
in the whole
out how
world.
To use it.
Yeah, man, go use it. Like solve a unique problem. Like the world, I always say it, the world didn't need one more Countrywide. Great company, did its thing, you know, right. That wasn't what we were trying to. There are 5,000 mortgage banks. The world doesn't need one more clone of another one, right? It didn't need 5,001. It needed companies that were going to enter the marketplace to solve new problems in
right.
new ways, like with new perspectives, man. I love that was, you said it was a simple decision because you saw a problem that you felt uniquely gifted, equipped to go attack. And the world needed that.
Yeah.
And you see, so you stepped out and did it.
Yeah.
That to me, if people ask, that is a great motivation, a great reason why. When they say, oh man, I think I can make 10% more than this, you go, all right, maybe not, but that's probably not going to drive you. Like, because I know there's going to be those high moments, and there's going to be those low moments. If you don't have a why that anchors you to your purpose, that's going to keep you walking through those valleys, if it's to make 10% more, just that it's not going to wake you up, it's not going to wake me up, man. If you have a purpose that you're like, I got to solve this problem for the U.S., for the world, because it's broken. And like, I know my mom and dad, like, were beneficiaries of you know, what
system.
It means to like
it
get
a
mortgage.
System.
Yeah, and we want to get more people experiencing the dream of homeownership, more people stable. And because we have that vision, because we have that dream, we're going to work through the tough times to make sure that happens. But if the why is not big enough, man, it won't carry you through the low points. And you had it out of the gate and anchored into it. And you've always talked to me about that, about wanting to fundamentally change the way banking's done in the U.S.
Yeah, and I agree. I couldn't agree more. Like, purpose-driven companies, they end up being the best.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, the West Coast does such a great job of that. We were talking East Coast, West Coast, right? There are different business cultures on the two different coasts. There really are. It's dramatic. It's been so awesome getting to spend time with you and your team and your relationships out on the West Coast. And the way you all think about the world with technology being able to scale and all the proximate examples you have of, you know, Google and Facebook and these companies that are right in your backyard that you've watched literally have impact around the world because of the power
right.
of technology. Whereas on the East Coast, you know, I think we have a much more kind of a little more old school, like people worry about earnings, they worry about, you know, kind of consumables and things. Hey, can I make money this quarter? Can I do something that has like tangible market value today? It's not so much about market share. It's about like, hey, earnings and that kind of thing. And there's a healthy marriage in there in between somewhere, man. But I love how mission first Silicon Valley companies are. You know, I think
some of them are, yeah.
Has like made that really popular, right? They'll talk about, hey, mission first, mission first, mission first. And yeah, there's probably examples of guys who don't do it well also.
Yeah. Well, I would say Netflix, by the way, really great. If you read their principles,
yeah.
if they're fantastic.
Yeah.
Like they are 100%. Something that you read and you're like, man, that really resonates with
yeah.
me.
We could be a part of that. Like it was for sports even, like the Bengals, right? Like every player on the team better have said mission first. It's not about me and my staff. It better
about
be about
the team,
the yeah. Super Bowl, like going to the championship and that we have great performance together. And I really do think, man, you know, Blend and Silicon Valley do an amazing job of talking about that and really promoting that inside their organizations.
Yeah, and I think that there's the ones that don't get it right, I think they're the ones who probably think about, it's not about revenue, it's about we need to spend all this and do all these things. And I think it's the ones who you know, the companies that have been successful have been mission for, not about revenue, but have been mission first. And I think that there's a really fine line. Like the mission, you can forego revenue for the mission if the mission will eventually lead to a real business. These are yeah. real businesses that we have to build.
Yes.
You know, Facebook, as much as they didn't talk about revenue early on, they
yeah.
knew they had to eventually build a business.
Yeah. yeah.
Whereas I think some companies, some of them, I think just sometimes lose that that in their long term. Anyways, yeah. So I think, principles are super important. When I think about who to hire, it's a balance too. You can't hire people who are all like yourself either.
Yeah.
So I try to find balance in that a little bit. Like, I'm not a super organized person. I don't know if you, are you organized?
I wouldn't say it's in my top five, no.
It's not in my top five. It's not in my top 100, okay. Right? And so, like, it's just like you find people who balance you out and so.
I love you that about you, though, man, is like, I've always felt like you are really comfortable talking about your weaknesses, and most of the best leaders I've been around, that a lot of times they've in conversation or in our relationships, they've led with their weaknesses. You know, whereas when guys are insecure, what you hear about is all about their strengths, right? And you have plenty of strengths that you could share with us, man. I think we'd all see them really, really quickly. But like, you've always kind of like led with your weaknesses and said, hey, here's some things I struggle with, and here's why I think about having a great team. And you know, to me, I love that old African proverb, right? If you want to go fast, go alone. You want to go far, go with others, man. And to go far, you need a great team that complements your weaknesses. And if as a leader, man, if you're not aware of your weaknesses, you're not going to go real far. Like, you're just not going to have a lot of success, because you do need other people to come with you right on the journey.
Yeah, no, and frankly, like, the whole idea is that you can build, and I think teams, it's really prominent in sports teams, right?
That's why you're going to be an amazing owner of the Bengals.
Like, imagine if everybody on your, you know, your Tampa Bay Buccaneers team looked and worked exactly like you.
Yeah, we would have been.
Your offensive line wouldn't have been great.
Real awful. Yeah.
Your running backs wouldn't have been great.
We actually would have done very little very well.
Yeah,
but yeah.
That's right. But I mean, it's like that's a really simple example where you can't have teams that are trying to accomplish a specific mission who are all homogeneous.
Absolutely.
And that's something that does worry me a little about Silicon Valley today, a little bit.
It looks really homogeneous.
I don't know. Maybe I'm not right about this, but it's to me, I worry about that because it did happen. I feel like it happened a little bit to Wall Street in the last big boom.
Yes.
And I worry that that's happening to Silicon Valley a little bit. And how do we make sure we have that same level of diversity of thought and diversity of people and diversity of skill sets, backgrounds? Because there are a lot of things that people are uniquely able to do that some people, I can't do certain things that other people can do.
Right.
And it's a long journey. Man. And by the way, the other thing that's really hard is that as the journey goes on, the needs change.
Needs shift, yeah.
And then you're like, man, I really need to evolve as a person.
Yep.
To be able to serve this company really, really well and this mission really, really well. And I need the people around me to evolve.
Yeah.
Or I need to bring in other people who can evolve or can take on the new roles, because they're, you know, when you guys are, what, 5,000 people now?
Yeah.
Sure, the needs are different today than
different level of leadership, different needs than when we were five and 50 and 500. And it evolved. So how do you keep growing as a leader?
I do a lot of, and this goes back to my poker days. There's this thing called session reviews where I would watch, part of my studying was I would watch my hands from like an hour.
You're watching your own game film.
I'd watch my own game film.
Okay.
Oh yeah, you probably have a lot of experience.
A little bit of that. Yeah. Watch a little bit of film.
I watch thousands of hours of game film a year.
So how do you do that in the business world?
I go back and I review everything that I do. Seriously. Like, I'll go back in decisions. I'll go and read things that I wrote up. I'll go back and look at my week and say, and just like, it's not like it's a formal process.
Yeah.
But I'm just like, did I make the right decision there? Was that meeting good?
So you're constantly kind of like reviewing actions and learning.
And asking around. Hey, like, what do you know? What
do you think about that?
What did you think about that?
Right.
Like,
right.
Do you think that they took away what we wanted them to take away? Do you think we could have said something different? And so, do you think that we built the right thing? You know, do you think that this could have been faster, or this thing could have been done instead?
Right.
And so a lot of introspection, which is not, I think it's not, again, because, and this is something where you have to be comfortable being wrong.
Yeah.
Because initially when you start to do these introspective sessions and you pull in others and you're doing it together as a group, we do this as a group sometimes too at Blend. People like when something they did was wrong, they feel like it was like their teacher telling them that they got a C.
Right, right.
And you're like,
I mean, Al Mulally talks about this a bunch, right? When he talks about the turnaround that he enacted at Ford. And actually the CEO that took over for him was the first leader in his CEO executive sessions that actually raised his hand and said he was having a problem. And his point is, I mean, this guy had the courage to raise his hand and say, hey, everything's not perfect in my world. Let me share with you a struggle I have. And then the whole team can come around him and help him. And that ended up becoming the next, you know, CEO of Ford. And I think it's the same thing. It's like, man, but can you create a safe enough environment in your executive team where guys can raise their hand and like say, hey, I have a problem. Or you know what? Maybe I didn't do this perfectly last week. It's something, man, where that's safe. To your point, people can make mistakes, and we're not asking for perfection, man. We're asking for like a consistent effort in the right direction and a unified vision of things, knowing that, man, because it starts with our own introspection. That's what I say. I always appreciate you. You're talking about your own weakness. Like you're like, hey, by the way, I'm gonna make a mistake. Probably made one this morning. You know, and I'll share it. I'll own it. We'll learn from it, and we'll get better together.
Yeah, and I think that. And by the way, I think if you encourage that, I recently just started building out with the team a program where we're going to offer blend branded poker chips to people who take smart risks and who are wrong.
Oh, love
just
it.
To encourage them, like, hey, we're not going to crucify you for doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, you're actually going to reward people.
And you did the right thing, made the right decisions, and it had the wrong outcome.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yes.
And so, like, how do you encourage that? It's hard because it's not natural.
Man, that's
as
awesome.
Much as you try to build it. And so, so I think
we all want to be safe. No one wants to be singled out. No one wants to fail in front of their peers. But it's crucial and necessary. You got to take risks.
In business, you have to take risks.
And keep evolving, because otherwise you look the same, look like everybody else.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about industry, man. What is going on right now in the mortgage, in the banking industry? How is this industry evolving? How is technology going to fundamentally impact and change the mortgage business over the next 5 years?
I think about 6 years ago, two things started happening. And we were very fortunate to be right at the beginning of these two trends. The first one was that there was a huge consumer movement towards digital, was just everyone and mobile. Everyone knows that. Everyone sees that now. Yeah. Everything's mobile. Prime checkout.
Yeah,
Uber.
Love it.
You know, like those
love
kinds
it.
Of things.
Yeah.
Who doesn't want one tap everything, right? Everybody wants that, and they start to gravitate towards services that offer that.
Yep.
It's not like there isn't an ability to call the cab company,
right,
and have them show up. I used to call the San Francisco cab before Uber was around. Cab company, and half the time I'd get like a static on the other end. Half the time they'd answer it, and the car would never show up. And it's just like, this doesn't make. Of course, I'm going to use the service that's one tap.
Yep.
Why wouldn't I? And so there's that one movement around, you know, this kind of like one tap economy. And then the other thing that's happening, and digital, I think, is a centerpiece, and mobile is a centerpiece of that. And the other thing that's happening is more and more of the information that consumers need to get these products, these financial products, is available to them, which. In the past world, it wasn't available to them. It was available to them in the form of a paper document.
Yeah. We're clearly making the transition from a document-driven environment to a data-driven environment.
It's
not as fast as a lot of us would like. It could speed up because it's a very interconnected ecosystem with the federal government, a lot of agencies, banks, everyone else. But like that shift is clearly occurring. So what are the implications of our industry moving from a document-driven industry to a data-driven industry?
Well, I think in combining those two things, I think we have the opportunity now, you know, to, I think not even in the next 5 years, but in the next 6 months, for some percentage of customers, offer them a one-tap approval.
Mm.
And like that is a fundamental shift in the industry. It's like you have control of your own data, consumer.
Yep.
If you are interested in our products as a lender, we're going to give you a one-tap approval. And by the way, we're going to be the genius bar for you. We're going to help you understand if this is even the right product for you and what a different product might be, and et cetera. We're going to be the genius bar to help you through this process, but we're not going to make the paperwork part of the process as onerous as it used to be. And so it's just not going to be that way anymore. So that, I think that we should assume that we're going to live in a world in 3 years.
We're consumer going to have a one-tap mortgage experience.
Yeah, we should all be assuming that.
So what is the role then of the loan officer look like? Because a lot of guys would ask the question, man, am I going to be out of business? Are machines going to take my job? I have some perspectives on that, but I'm curious, as one of the leading technologists in our space, what your perspective on that is.
I got to hear the guy who built the Apple Store with Steve Jobs in like the early 2000s and grow that. And he said the thing that they underestimated, which was the most important part of the Apple Store.
Yeah.
The reason the Apple Store is success is the most success. It's like one of the most successful retail stores in the world right now. And Apple is a transcendent company that there's so many chess moves ahead of everybody else right now that it's crazy. But
you gonna share some of those?
But I think that and he said that the really brilliant part of what we did is we created this thing called the Genius Bar.
Yeah.
Where we put really smart people who knew our products, and we put them in front of the customer, and everybody else was escaping and trying to go digital and trying to remove humans from the equation. And we're like, no, we're going to try to get people in front of people because they want to come to a place where they can be served how they want to be served.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really interesting point. Amazon's building physical locations. You know, it's like it's just this natural thing where people are realizing that people are super important to know. I don't think
we actually like relationships. We trust human beings. I kind of talk to people all the time about the millennials. Millennials say, millennials are not social. I go, man, this might be one of the most social generations ever. They interact a little differently.
It's different,
but it's not social. We still want people. I know Palantir's perspective, and I know yours always has been, hey, there's a power in the power of people plus machines with superior process.
Yeah.
You know, and that synergy created is what leads to kind of exponential productivity and really humans flourishing, right? And so I know that's my perspective as well. We talk a lot about with our sales guys, we'd say to any loan officers out there in the field that are wondering, what are machines going to do to my job? So, man, machines are going to do the parts of your job that are tactical, the parts that you probably hated, the paperwork, the stuff that isn't like innately you. It's not like an innate gift you have. What you're going to get compensated to do is that stuff that's uniquely human, right? Develop relationships, consult with people about this asset that might be the largest asset to ever sit on their balance sheet, that's going to like be part of their family's hopes and dreams and put them in the right product in the right way with the right structure and guide them through that process, kind of like a Genius Bar experience, right? Yeah. What you're not going to get compensated to do is collect all the documents that qualify for that product.
That's just that's the old, I mean, that I couldn't agree more. Yeah. If people think of you as a genius around mortgages, they'll want to refer all their friends to you.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll send you more business if they're a partner. Like, I mean, that's what.
So loan officers that embrace this, my perspective, have an opportunity to do more business than they've ever done in their career. And enjoy it more because they're going to be more in the consultative relationship building part of the business, less in the document driven collection part of the business.
Yeah, and by the way, their customers will be happier.
Customers will be happy.
Because they're not going to be sitting there rummaging around for documents that could have just been electronically submitted in 5 seconds. And so, I think that's like part of what's happening. And I think that's definitely something that I'm pretty excited about. I also think that the other parts of the process that are onerous around, because it's not just the approval, there's more to it than that, right? You know, you have to get underwritten and you have to get an appraisal and title and homeowner's insurance and things like that. And so I think that's going to be those things are going to be simple.
All those elements be contained in a one-click environment.
Yeah, one-stop shop for the customer.
All the services that go with it will be able to be accomplished with one click at some point.
It has to be, right? Yeah. Because at the end of the day, those things are all part of the same, like they're trying to move into their home.
All the same transaction.
They're all in the same transaction. Yep. Don't make them go to Fiverr. Don't make them call the guy down the street to do their, I don't know, whatever moving services they need to do, just give them the ability to do that electronically. And so that's what good companies do, is they bring those things together for their customers, so their customers have a fantastic experience. And I think that I think even now, as I think about companies that are going in a certain direction, you know, the market's tough right now.
Yeah.
Right? I'm sure you know this, right?
But, yeah.
Like the companies that are able to adopt these technologies, the LOs will grow market share, but the companies are able to adopt and really use this to make their products and their services better, they're going to flourish. They're the ones who are going to come out the other side twice as big as they came in. And so I think that's what I hope that's what happens is the companies, and then the good, that's just a natural thing. It's like companies that don't adopt technology.
Go the way of the dinosaurs, man, right? You got
to evolve.
You
have to evolve.
It's just like the game changes, the environment changes. Yep.
I have to evolve as an individual or I'll be out a CEO.
That's right.
The company has to evolve. Every company has to evolve because the world around us is changing.
Well, Naaman, we are rooting for you, man. Thank you so much, man, for your friendship. Thank you for sharing the story with so many guys. I know, man, they're going to be encouraged because you really do have an amazing story. The courage of your parents to move, bring their family to a new country, didn't even speak the language, the success they had here, the success that you've had here, man. I think it's an example to all of us. I'm proud to be partnered with you, man. And I know we are all excited to see where you lead Blend in the future.
Yeah. Thanks, Casey.
All right, brother.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Mortgage Impact Podcast. You can find old episodes, show notes, and much more at mortgageimpactpodcast.com and wherever you get your podcasts. Please like, comment, and share, and we look forward to having you back on a future episode.